Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We trust you had a wonderful Easter weekend, and we're glad you've joined us here to start the new week. And we have good, bad, and crazy martinis for you, as usual. Jim, we start with the good, and it's always premature to be talking about the next presidential election before the midterms have even had most of their primaries yet. But Eliana Johnson for National Review has a new piece out on Indiana Governor Mike Pence. This is a guy who was rumored to be a candidate in 2012. He decided to leave the House and run for governor of Indiana instead. By all accounts, he's done a pretty good job there. And so now the buzz is once again circulating around him because people like to have governors on the ticket. He and Scott Walker are probably getting the most buzz right now, in addition to Chris Christie, of course, on the Republican side. So we'll see if he gets in. The odd part is he would have to decide between that and running for re-election because Indiana's governorship comes up in presidential election years. But as Eliana points out, he's very popular among social conservatives. He's got a pretty good record both in Congress and in Indiana of being a small government guy. Didn't even vote for the go-along-to-get-along things like No Child Left Behind or Medicare Part D. He was a leading opponent of TARP and so forth. So if people are looking for a guy who can look to all three legs of the conservative stool, he's one of the better candidates, it seems.
I've always liked him and remember last time around wondering if he would be a possibility. He really struck me as one of those guys who had that right mesh of certainly having the conservative credentials to be a, like if you're a Tea Party and you don't like Mike Pence, at that point, I think you're not taking things seriously. You're not looking at a guy who can actually get serious conservative reforms done. But also the flip side is that he'd been in Congress. He was not some guy who was touting his inexperience or lack of familiarity with things. And he seemed like that right mix of impassioned and with grassroots authenticity, but also being serious, a guy who can get things done. And as governor, just a couple of interesting thoughts. One thing that jumps out is that I remember he was giving a speech in Berlin. He said diplomacy with Russia has failed. We need to install missile defenses in Poland and stuff like that. So when the governor of Indiana goes out to Berlin, and gives a very Cold War, foreign policy oriented, tough, hawkish speech, people notice and people say, wait a minute, that's not something the governor of Indiana usually thinks about. That's the sort of thing a potential president thinks about. And we will see whether this actually is meant to be something. Eliana had a key piece. Also kind of interesting was Bloomberg News Service wrote a piece on him. Mike Pence, comma, a Coke favorite, comma, Moles 2016 run for president. Now you look at that, it's like, really? That's the first thing you want to know about is, he's a Coke favorite. It's written by Jonathan Allen. I'm going to, pop quiz, Greg. Do you recognize that name?
Allen sounds familiar, but not Jonathan Allen.
He was one of the Allens over at Politico, Mike Allen being one of the other ones.
Sure.
Jonathan Allen worked at Politico for a long time. Actually, recently wrote that recent book on Hillary Clinton's State Department years, HRC.
Okay.
But if you go back a little bit further, Jonathan Allen in 2010 worked for Debbie Wasserman Schultz for about 40 days. And then he decided he didn't like it and he wanted to go back to being a Democrat. And so, for the whole bunch of us kind of remember at the time, once you go to work for Debbie Wasserman Schultz, I don't think we can call you a nonpartisan journalist. But then you talk about, it didn't take long to figure out that partisan politics wasn't the right fit for me. Okay, whatever, you're willing to take the job. She's not hiring me, for example, And so here's Jonathan Allen. He just happens to describe Pence in his affiliation with the, big, mean, scary Koch brothers and how terrible they are. So if he's already getting attacked as a presidential contender, maybe that's another sign that he's a guy to be taken seriously. But no, I think he would only add to the field. Very intriguing guy. We'll see what happens. I'll be in Indiana later this week to assess whether the state is, doing well or whether it's all falling apart under him. And my guess is that the state's doing well. Also worth noting, Indiana is one of two states that is opting out of Common Core, which is an issue that really sets the hair on fire for the conservative grassroots. That is a issue not to be ignored or brushed aside, and I think that could end up causing huge headaches for, say, Jeb Bush if he were to decide to run for president in 2016.
All right, on to the bad martini today, and this is more bad news for Obamacare, despite what the president tried to say on Thursday about how it's a proven success and why don't Republicans just move on and maybe try to figure out how it could work just even a little bit better. But Georgia insurers have received more than 220,000 applications for health coverage in the Affordable Care Act's exchange as of the official federal deadline of March 31st, state officials said on Wednesday. Insurance Commissioner Ralph Hudgens said premiums have been received for only 107,581 of those policies, which cover 149,465 people. So, Jim, less than half of the premiums have been paid. We don't know what it's going to look like in other states, but that estimate in Georgia is certainly far worse than anything we were suspecting on a nationwide scale. So the idea that this is a settled victory, as the president would like to couch it, we're a long way from that.
You're looking at that and rather surprised that we've seen non-payment rates, you know, they bounce around. Some insurers are saying it's in the neighborhood of 10%, some putting a little higher, 20, 25%. This as half is a really frightening number for the insurers. And in a certain sense that, you know, do some of these folks really think when they signed up for this thing, they were getting something for free? What couple of, you know, so somebody's like, well, you know, because a lot of those policies were covering more than one person, it's up to 66% who have paid. And that's swell. Obviously, I'm guessing a large number of those are spouses and dependents and children and things like that. The other quick defense that gets thrown out from Obamacare defenders is, well, look, you know, they are due till May 1st. Okay, that's like, what, 9 days from now? Are some of these people going to pay by the end of the month? Sure, sure. There's, you know, there's like 100,000 people there. So chances are for some of them, the check is in the mail. I put this up on Campaign Spot, and it's already been linked to a Drudge, so people are hearing about this. I had one reader who was in bill collections, who, you know, doing this for non-insurance premiums, but another field said, look, you know, just as we suspect, the line, the check is in the mail, is very common from folks, and a lot of people will say that they're going to pay something, and of course, obviously, they don't. They may not pay because they don't have the money. They may, you know, not pay because they've already spent the money on something else. It's possible some of these people ended up getting hired at jobs and are now getting insurance for their employer and thus don't need the insurance they signed up for earlier. It's possible, I suppose. But look, we're talking about more than 100,000 people here. Most of these people are not going to pay by the end of the month. And most of these people are going to end up having their policies canceled because you don't get something for nothing. And, you know, later on, we can talk more about the problem of, you know, having health insurance doesn't necessarily mean access to a doctor. But it kind of shows that, you know, here's Obama throwing around this 8.1 million number and not really thinking through the possibility. Look, it doesn't really count for anything if people don't pay and the policies get canceled in a month or two.
Yeah. And when you factor in the folks who had to sign up in the exchange because they had their old policy that they liked canceled, we'll see what those numbers are. If the insurance companies or the government can ever actually put together those sorts of numbers, we'll find out. On to the crazy martini now. And as Jim said, possibly literally the crazy martini. Once upon a time, about 6 years ago, Tim Russert was dominating the Sunday morning talk shows in terms of the ratings. And I'm using that term pretty lightly. This Washington Post story by Paul Farhi says that Russert once had a 40% edge in ratings over his rivals. Now Meet the Press, under David Gregory's tutelage, is in third place. It's behind both Face the Nation, which is now in first place, and then This Week. And they're trying to figure out what's going wrong there, and they say they're not going to get rid of David Gregory anytime soon. But here's the paragraph that kind of struck us both as a bit odd. Last year, the network, meaning NBC, undertook an unusual assessment of the 43-year-old journalist, commissioning a psychological consultant to interview his friends and even his wife. The idea, according to a network spokesman, was to get perspective and insight from people who know him best. But the research project struck some at NBC as odd, given that Gregory has been employed there for nearly 20 years. Jim, I'm not sure you need to bring in the psychologists here. There's just no buzz anymore on this show. I can't think of a single time where anybody said, oh, did you see what David Gregory turned that guy into knots on Sunday?
Yeah, it was a really fascinating article on several fronts. First being, look, there's nothing wrong with seeing a therapist or a psychologist. You know, lots of folks do it. If Tony Soprano can do it, I think we can say, you know, dispense with the notion that there's not something manly about seeing a therapist or a mental health professional. What was kind of intriguing was the idea that they would do this in order to help improve the performance of the show, talking to the wife and things like that. That just seems very unusual. And not quite clear how seeing it, like, you'd just be curious about, so what did NBC get for all that? That it certainly didn't seem like, you know, there was a sudden dramatic improvement in Gregory's performance of all that. The second thing is that elsewhere in that article, it talks about how they're changing the show to do quicker segments and more variety of topics, get in and out and all stuff like that. And it completely misses what the secret to Meet the Press was. And I'm kind of struck that nobody else has observed it. I remember reading this about Russert a long time ago. So all the Sunday shows are put on by the networks, and they set up their schedules, and NBC uniquely had set it up so that in the first half of Meet the Press, they didn't have to take a commercial break. Now, some weeks they would take it, some weeks they wouldn't, but that basically once you sat down for your interview at Meet the Press, some of them were taped ahead of time, but most of them were live. You couldn't stall. The interview subject couldn't just, you know, filibuster and talk about, I believe in, you know, children of the future, teach them well and let them lead the way. You know, all their standard usual boilerplate that they use to fill time until the interviewer, frustrated that they haven't gotten the answer that they want, will say, oh, well, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us, Senator so-and-so. Russert, uniquely amongst morning show hosts, at least Sunday morning show hosts, was able to say, oh, you know, the person in front of him could give him a long blathering non-answer. And then Russert could ask the exact same question again. And then watch it go through it again, and then do it again. And basically ask the same question three or four times, sometimes rewording it, until he got to the answer that he was really looking for. And usually these were tough questions that forced the interview subject to take a stand and not, you know, and having to, you know, alienate one side or the other, or, you know, not be able to give this milquetoast mashed potato type answer. And those were good answers. Those were newsworthy answers. Those were the ones that people started talking about. And that's what gave Russert his good reputation as a questioner. Also, he did fantastic preparation. You know, if you were running for president in Iowa, and back 10 years ago, you'd said the Iowa caucuses were the stupidest idea you'd ever heard, and the bunch of, you know, corn picking, you know, nincompoops out there making the choice on caucus night. He found that video, or he found that quote or something like that. And then he put it up in front of the person, and we get to watch the person dissembling and sputtering and stuff like that. So to me, those were the secrets of what made Russert a good interviewer. And as a, you know, participant in roundtable segments, I love them. I'm glad to have them. But I don't think you necessarily say, oh, you got to watch that, or people kind of, you know, demanding to tune into that. Whereas, well, the interviews were generally what would, you know, create the buzz and make you say, oh, my goodness. Gregory doesn't seem to ask those tough questions. There are a lot of folks who say he tends to, you know, more or less take it easy on his Democratic guests. And what's more is, if you're going to this quicker in and out, you know, routine, then you're not going to get any more of those dramatic moments or great quotes, or even, you know, a good interviewer has to get a little contentious every now and then, or ask things that the interview subject doesn't want to hear. And I don't know if we've ever had a moment where, you know, Gregory really got good at that. So kind of a crazy martini, not in the sense that David Gregory is crazy, but that the NBC brass's assessment of what's wrong at Meet the Press seems so different from what actually appears to be wrong to those of us in the viewing audience.
We'll be watching that as well. Jim, good to have you back. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg. See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.